Hi everybody, it is 12:30 and we have just finished reading some paperwork regarding our eldest child, and we're feeling incredibly triggered, and I thought I'd just post a quick reflection. I actually don't know where to start, to be honest with you. My eldest is almost seven. His journey started at two when he was flagged up as being different. We actually did notice things before, but things started to become more obvious at two. To two and a half, and then his sensory world from three onwards, I think that's fair to say, became such a prominent difficulty for him that, you know, things just haven't been the same since. I'm not going to harp on about the low and high functioning debate again, but what we find really hard as his parents is people look at him at a glance, and because he looks okay, and seriously, that's the wording people have used, but he looks okay, he doesn't look autistic. People don't take into consideration just how challenged he is and actually what a challenge it is to parent him. And recently we've had a lot of people online saying that they won't tolerate parents discussing how hard it is to raise autistic children because it's deemed as being very disrespectful. But actually, a lot of our challenges we were just discussing are not just down to the challenges he brings, obviously, as an autistic individual. We are autistic ourselves, and I think that that's really helped us with parenting him in so many ways, because we understand on a very internal level a lot of his drives and urges and behaviours, and so we've been able to help him very naturally from an early age. I've kind of lost my point there. but actually, I think where the most stress comes from is these external forces, which I've talked about before. It's these processes you have to go through. It's trying to jump through all the hoops to try and get the support in place for your children. And for us, for him, I just can't understand it. From the age of two, he has been so obviously challenged. We have two children who are challenged in very different ways. So we're a family of autistics, and each of us have overlapping experiences, but we also have our very own unique experiences, which is, you know, the whole point that we're trying to make on the blog constantly, is that you can't put any of us into one neat little box. You cannot categorize any of us because we are not all the same, but obviously we will have shared experiences, and we will understand certain things about other people's experiences. But he just gets to, we've been told so many times he is high functioning because he can talk. And this child is not high functioning. I don't even believe in that terminology, as you know, because I've shared that before. It's inadequate. It doesn't adequately express the challenges he faces every day. You know, people will often say to me on the blog, well, you know, he's not like my two-year-old who can't talk. But this is the thing about autism. When you're two, you might not be able to talk. That doesn't mean at six you won't. That doesn't mean at 10 you won't. I think what the point is with autism is, you tend to develop differently, but it doesn't mean you won't get there. Some people won't get there. We've already been told he has gaps in his skills that may just suddenly click and may not develop ever. And we don't know what his future is going to hold. And that's what's quite scary. But instead of trying to dwell on that, we try and just, you know, celebrate him for who he is and support him as he is and let him develop in his own time. I don't want him being forced to do things he's clearly not ready to do, otherwise he would be doing them. And people say to force them into hours of therapy, but, you know, he's also a PDA-er and he would absolutely resist that anyway, like he does everything else in life. But I just wouldn't put him through it. I want him to actually enjoy his little life, and there's some of the things he does that people would try to suppress that I don't want suppressed. I like the fact that he is just so naturally, I think, gleeful about very simple things in life that not everybody, you know, appreciates or sees. So I don't want those things to change. But there are things about him that do cause difficulties. For example, he is so impulsive, and we've been out recently and he ran away, I think, four separate times, didn't he? And, you know, he won't think twice about trying to run into a road. Now, obviously, as parents, we are aware of this and we're on top of it, but it's stressful. And I think that's what people don't realise. I think in a way, because we've learned so many strategies, we appear so much more together than I think people realise we are. Like, they don't see the anxiety it causes to actually take him out and to keep him safe. So at surface level, I have actually been told, I am so lucky. I'm so lucky to have a child like him who can talk. The annoyance for me is I know non-verbal autistic children who are not as challenged as he is. They can't talk, but they can still communicate in different ways, but they don't have the same impulsivity and attention difficulties that he has. And again, that's not saying all non-verbal children fit that criteria, but I think this is the problem with these labels, and we really do need to acknowledge that. The reason that I am bringing this up is because my child has been going through this now since the age of 2 years old. He is nearly seven. This year, at the age of six, we were kind of forced. We had no option but to seek a private diagnosis for him, because we were getting nowhere. We were just getting absolutely nowhere. Waiting on a pathway that I was off the record once told that he'd been bumped down because we appeared to be coping so well. I don't know if that is actually true, but it was definitely said to us. And it was said by a couple of professionals that perceived that was happening. And do you know what? At the time, I took it as a compliment to my parenting. And I thought, good, it means another child can have his place, if that makes sense, in the line. But actually, it's really wrong. This is what they do. They do all these tricks and they manipulate you so that you back off almost and you don't fight. And if they can't do it in kind of by charming you and manipulating you, they then kind of just attack you and keep turning you down and making things very hard for you in the hopes, I think, that you give up. It's just absolutely horrific what he has been through and what we have been through as a family. So externally we get, oh, he's high functioning because he can talk, yet people just don't have a clue. There are so many things he can't do socially, physically. And I'm not sharing this to belittle him or to complain about him, because he's wonderful and sensitive and loving and kind. But he does have issues with things I've already shared before, like making connections. He cannot see the big picture in things. He does not naturally see danger. He is impulsive. He cannot control himself. Like, absolutely. There are so many examples I could give you. It's not really what this is about today, but it's very hard to explain the experience we have to people who don't live it. And I'm actually going to go so far as to say, even when you speak sometimes to other autistic parents of autistic children, they don't always get it, because guess what? All of our experiences are not the same. My children are PDAs, which brings other challenges, which again, I'm not going to go into today. But as an example, I have one friend with PDA children and she totally gets it. I know other parents of PDAs who have a slightly different experience to us. And our youngest, for example, is very extreme and is more extreme than a lot of those other children. So you don't always get the empathy and understanding that you're craving. And that is what the difficulties come in. And it's not about complaining about the children, but when you have children who are different and sometimes present a little bit more typically, like our youngest child, you just feel, I don't know what the word would be. What would you say? Alone, misunderstood, and then isolated, because we have to just keep away from everybody, because for our own self-preservation and our own mental health, it's just easier. But when you're dealing with professionals and year after year, you nod and you grin and you do all the right things and it gets you nowhere, you lose faith in the system and you do start to grow frustrated and you start to grow angry. And then they just see you as hostile and they, you know, kind of label you that parent, and they don't see the build-up that has got you to that stage, and they don't see you as a human being, and they don't see your child as a human being. And quite frankly, they don't really care about them. They don't care about what is actually best for them. It's just a job to them and it's a tick box exercise. It is a case reference. But I think what's triggered me this evening is some of the stuff I've read. To think that this child has been on this pathway since two, they don't know him. Everything they write is wrong. So we're going through the review process at the moment for his EHCP, and none of it actually reflects him or his needs very adequately. And we feel we've been very, very clear. I've even written an awful lot of information to a number of professionals, and the fact that they're either not understanding or they are intentionally missing the point. I mean, we said that reading it earlier, it sounded a bit loaded, some of it, as though,
like you're being steered in a certain direction.
Yeah, it's really hard to explain. I will try When things have developed further and I know more, because obviously we need to challenge this now, I can share with you more about, you know, some of the things that were written and what we've challenged and what the outcomes are. But essentially, it just feels like we're being told, do what we tell you or otherwise we're not going to support you. That's basically, you know, and we haven't had any support up until this point.
That's the status quo then.
Yeah, we haven't had any support whatsoever. And, you know, this debate on the low and high functioning, which I will just quickly refer to, people saying that high functioning, I mean, obviously my son is just clearly not what you would deem high functioning, but because he can talk, that is the box people are trying to put him into. And it's just so insulting. It really is.
It's ethically wrong.
It's so wrong. But what you hear all the time is these high functioning autistics are trying to take away from the low functioning autistics. And it's not the case. Every autistic individual has strengths and weaknesses. And yes, there are some people who have, you know, many more challenges. And for example, myself as an autistic individual, I would never put myself in that category or take any support from anyone. But at the same time, as an autistic person, there are challenges you face, and mine are more social. So what is wrong with saying, look, I need people to understand me? I have not, as an individual, received any support whatsoever for being autistic.
Yeah.
There's nothing. But what I have done is I've learned about who I am. I have found support online through advocates, through support groups, and I can now advocate for my own needs. And some of those things might just be that I now have the confidence to not go to certain social events. I'm not feeling pressured into doing things that actually were making me very, very miserable. I felt before that I was a failed neurotypical and I was forcing myself to do things that everybody else seemed okay doing, and I couldn't understand why they were hard for me. I'm much kinder to myself about things that I struggle with, like even just keeping my home together, because I now understand with executive dysfunction that that can be an issue. You know, you're not asking for any physical resources and you're not asking for any funding. And I certainly don't get disability, which is something that we were accused of online. It's just crazy. And actually, I advocate for autistic people and their individual needs. And it doesn't matter what needs they are. I don't think that one person should be taking away from another. I don't understand that perception.
It's not robbing Peter to pay Paul in this situation.
No, not at all.
Some people have made it about that and it's never been about that.
No.
Why can't everyone get the help they require and the adjustments that they need on an individual basis?
And I was once told that my son, because again, he can introduce himself, he can use some scripts and he can talk, but he will keep repeating that script and he can't come off script and he can't have a reciprocal conversation with you. He can literally talk at you and monologue at you about his interests. That's pretty much, I mean, he's nearly seven. Would you say we've ever had an actual conversation with him?
Not one deep conversation.
But because he can talk, people mistake that as him being conversational, and it's not the same thing. We don't mind. We just join him in his interests, and just, you know, that's how
enjoy
we...
Enjoy him on his terms.
We enjoy him on his terms, and we connect with him in that way. But what is really upsetting is, because he can talk, I've had people even dismiss his needs. He has a lot of tics. He has a lot of social and communication difficulties. He has so many repetitive behaviours and OCD, sensory issues. His world really is difficult and it's challenging and it's scary. And we are often trapped in the house. He will not go out of the house. He had horrendous school-based trauma, which he's still trying to recover from. And I've had people actually say to me that he doesn't actually deserve anything either because he's so high-functioning. And I just don't know from what I've described how anybody could say that's a high-functioning child just because he can speak, because he is verbal. And it's really insensitive. And I feel that this is the problem we've now come up against with professionals. Now, somebody might question, well, the professionals must know what they're doing. I need to tell you something, okay? Since COVID, nobody's actually physically seen him. They haven't even seen him via Zoom. They've just spoken to us. So every single thing that they're offering to put into, well, not even offering to put into place because nothing's put into place, but
it's based on third party information.
It is. And no one's actually seen him. And the bit that's just riled me is reading a section that says, is a reassessment necessary? You know, basically to see him and...
Sorry, reassessment would indicate that there was an assessment to begin with.
There has never been an assessment. I think you've hit the nail on the head. That is my issue. No one's actually assessed him, and there's been excuse after excuse. But my youngest since has actually been through assessment and has been seen physically by people. And my eldest has seen one professional, and that was something he had been referred to a very long time ago that he has been in the waiting list for a very long time. But nobody else seems interested in actually seeing him. So all of these assumptions are being made about him, and yet nobody's actually visited him, assessed him, watched him. So we've even taken lots of videos, haven't we, to try and show the difficulties he has, and nobody wants to watch them. And we asked if we could send them to the educational psychologist because she's not coming to see him. And she said no, because of, is it data protection? She can't see them. It's just a very flawed system, and I'm really angry. But to be told that no reassessment is needed when he's not actually been assessed in person ever is just shocking to me. And the only way we're getting physical appointments at the moment is, surprise, surprise, if we pay for them.
Which is always seem to be doing is having to put your hand in your wallet, and for people living in the UK, that you shouldn't have to do that.
And we've been really lucky because our families, both sides, have helped us this year to fund private appointments for both children. And some people say, well, you could have waited, but we would have been waiting years longer. I mean, the fact that we've actually got the diagnosis for him is the only reason that they have now said that they will kind of consider this review, that they think it needs to be changed.
Otherwise it would have been mocked off as elective home education.
But you know what my issue is? Since 2 years old, this child has been suffering and struggling.
No one cares.
And his preschool tried to help him, and no one helped the preschool. They tried to get support in place for when he started school, and they were told no. They were told no, let's see how he gets on in school. And EHCP was not even considered for assessment. At the time, we didn't know you could kind of challenge these things. So, eventually we did our own parental request. But basically, I think what my point is that everything has been very slow, very drawn out.
The information is hidden from you, it's not accessible, so that you're never in an informed decision-making position for the rights to advocate for your own child.
And it feels like it is purposely hidden from you. And from the things we've learned, we are now not having so far the same experience with our youngest, because we've put everything into place a lot earlier.
Absolutely.
And I applied for his EHCP before he started school, and people criticise that, but I'm not having a repeat of what's happened with our eldest. But I feel like he's one of those children, again, he's invisible. And because he's currently not in school, nobody cares.
That is essentially, at the minute, he's no longer in school, he's no one's problem but us.
Yeah. And they do keep trying to push elective home education on us, which is not what we want.
We never stipulated that in the first place.
The frustration for me is the first time that we applied for his assessment for his EHCP, we were told without a diagnosis, he cannot even be considered for specialist school or any of them. I was then told, oh no, some might consider him. But generally speaking, they wouldn't. They said, because he doesn't have a diagnosis, we will say he can cope in mainstream. Which
clearly
he clearly couldn't. I think this is the frustration for me. And then suddenly we go and pay for a diagnosis and everything's changed. He can now qualify for a specialist school,
which will so be suitable to his needs,
which we know currently is not suitable, but we will cross that bridge when we come to it. We've made that really clear. And then people think that we're just lightly saying, no, we just want to keep him at home. He is still recovering from school-based trauma. If you even mention school, he has meltdowns and cries and gets upset.
Yes.
I mentioned something earlier about school, didn't I? And he just said, no, because I had a really bad time there. It's really tough. But sadly, you get these little glimmers of things from him where he'll say things. But I tried to interview him the other day because I was given a form to complete, and it said to get the child's voice, which is obviously really important. But he cannot process what he's being asked. And at one point I said to him, would you like to go to school? If they could find somewhere for you to go to school, would you like to go? That sounds nice. and he hadn't really processed what I was asking him. And then later when he realised... does that mean I'd have to go to school? I was like, well, if they can find you one that you like, of course you could go. And he got really upset. But he's an unreliable source because, again, he doesn't... On the surface level, he'll say the things he is used to hearing people say, or he thinks you want to hear. He has enough ability to basically mimic. And I'd say that that's his, most of his communication is either scripted or things he's heard. It's like echolalia, things he's heard through games or television. Yeah. But you see, some people would hear what I've just said there and go, well, no, he obviously had an understanding to say, oh, it makes me feel bad. But again, I think that's because he at the time was suffering from a lot of trauma. He was very distant. He was having meltdowns. And I think they were the words that a lot of the adults around him from school and at home were trying to help him label his emotions. So those things have come from emotion labeling. It's not because he actually has an understanding. When he was being diagnosed, the lady asked him a lot of questions about what made him happy, what made him sad, when he felt lonely, confused, and he didn't actually know how to answer them.
It's, what's the condition,
Alexithymia? Yeah. It's when I think you can't properly identify and articulate your emotions and feelings, and that is definitely him.
He's a strong candidate for that.
Yeah. So we've now been told they think he might have an intellectual disability, and you have to meet, I think, 3 impairments and score under 70 for your IQ. He does meet a lot of the criteria. Whether he'll actually qualify as intellectually disabled, I'm not sure, but definitely his social and communication skills, I don't think he's going to necessarily score very highly in those areas. So he might well come out with an intellectual disability score as well, but I'll keep you posted on that one. But I'm going to tell you what my actual issue is here.
I think it's comprehension as well, because if he doesn't understand the questions being asked, then he's going to score lower.
And that is part of the problem, but then I suppose they'll argue, well, you know, that in itself is enough. But the problem we have is his cognition and learning ability, as long as you cater it to his needs and his interests, and you do it in a very organic way, which is what we do, he actually has the ability to learn. And so far, people have mentioned specialist provision, and they've mentioned him going somewhere where basically, well, his cognition and learning will not be addressed. There is no expectation for him to learn anything academically.
That's just wrong.
Now, for me, his social and emotional needs are more important than anything else. And I've always said this to you, haven't I?
Yes.
That even if he could be somewhere where they can help with that emotional regulation and support us with those skills and those social skills with him, and I don't mean in an ABA way, I mean so that he has opportunities to be around other children. So as an example, we went to the speech and language therapist at the complex developmental disorder team, and she said he's not developmentally ready to socialise with other children. He's very controlling, he can't take turns. And then people say, well, he has to learn. He physically can't. And she actually validated that and said he's not developmentally ready to do a lot of these skills. And there's too much to go into, but there were so many examples of his PDA as well. And but at the same time, we sometimes see these glimmers when we go out and he might latch on to another child. It's always one child, isn't it, in particular, who will mummy him, basically. I'd say that that's what happens, which is really typical with autistic children and adults. Actually, you either kind of get bullied or you get mummied. I think they're the two things. Someone either takes you under their wing or they pick on you, usually. And but he saw a little girl the other day when we went out for a walk, and they were running together, and it was just so lovely, and it made me emotional, and I cried because I felt like he was missing out. But then I do realise he can only tolerate that for a few moments, and then he can't be around children for too long. He finds it difficult because he likes to tell them what to do. Everything has to be on his terms and in his control. And some people say to me, how is he going to learn if he's not in that situation? But as the SALT explained, he isn't actually ready to be in that situation. So you can't force play dates and you can't force these social skills. But what I would like is for him, you know, to have opportunities. So it's not forced, but if he wants it, it's there. I don't know if I'm explaining that very well, but, you know, he has a brother and he has cousins, and that's wonderful. So I'm not worried from that perspective, but seeing how he interacted with that little girl the other day, I just feel so upset sometimes that I feel he's being denied those experiences because he can't be in a mainstream school. And so far, there has been no specialist provision that has been deemed suitable, and no one would even consider him anyway because he had no diagnosis.
And this is the position you end up in.
And it is the position you end up in. And it's so annoying because... So
if you were to play the waiting game and go along with their trajectory, he would be probably years lost in the system with no piece of paper.
Even more years. I mean, I'm angry at how many years it's been. I feel like we should have done this sooner, like we've now done for our youngest, but you live and you learn. And sadly, our eldest child has been the experimental child, which I think a lot of parents say they learn a lot from their eldest. But I think what's really hard is our eldest has got such distinct challenges. I actually can't understand how he's been left this long. I can't understand how, in conscience, they could leave him and leave us in, you know, without this support. I'm not explaining things well because I am really triggered at the moment, but I just had to kind of share this with you. Basically, they keep saying, oh, you know, we don't want people feeling they need a diagnosis. We've got too many people on the pathway. You know, we need to be more needs-based. And that's wonderful if that happens.
In reality, it doesn't happen that way.
No.
They just gaslight you into submission.
At the moment, there are children, so many children on the waiting list, so many people, adults as well, on waiting lists. So many of us actually being rejected because they just cannot deal with the workload, really, the caseload. It's impossible. So a lot of people are being told and advised to go private, as I was. I met all of the criteria on the screening tool, as I've shared in another podcast, but they just couldn't accept me because as far as they're concerned, I'm not impacted enough. And again, that's another debate that's happened on my page where people say, well, you're not impacted enough. Look at you running a blog. Well, they have no idea what I've actually been through. And we now realise it's because I'm autistic and a lot of those social and communication issues were just not there for me. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where I'm 38 years old and I am too afraid to ever go back into a workplace. And clearly it's not because I'm not able, but I physically can't do it. I'm traumatised. I have issues now with people and trusting people. I won't go into great detail, but my point is you don't actually ever know what somebody's experiences are, and you can't look at somebody and know what's going on inside. And particularly if we're adults, we've learned a lot of coping strategies by this point, and we've learned how to mask, because we've learned that if we don't fit in and we don't do what we are supposed to be doing socially, like I said, forcing myself to do social things that I didn't want to do, because otherwise you are ostracized, then, well, that's the outcome. You end up having a really harder life, a harder existence. But people don't realise what's going on inside and how difficult these things are for you, and naturally how much they can traumatise you. But, you know, that's not the point of this podcast, really. But it does apply to our children, and people at surface level see them and think they're absolutely fine until they spend a few minutes with them or half an hour with them. And then it all starts to unfold and people can see, oh, wow, that was a script. That was a mask. And no, this child's now very dysregulated and is being very triggered by the sensory environment. And I'm just sick and tired of it, to be honest with you. But how these professionals cannot even see our child and have all this admin and paperwork about a person they've not seen and make decisions about. And I wouldn't say they've challenged us, because they haven't challenged us. They have taken everything on board we've said. But they don't know him. And at one point, they were kind of suggesting putting him into a placement where his academic needs were never, ever going to be catered for, because he doesn't need them, because he's not able. And that's the bit that really offended us.
It's just a fallacy, and it was clear that no one's actually seen him to make that assumption.
I think, how can you make such an important call?
This is how they're doing it. This is how accurate the level of diagnosis is, and the level of support and how they draw conclusions.
So you need a diagnosis to actually even be considered for anything outside of mainstream schooling, but trying to get your diagnosis is impossible pretty much unless you go private. It's just the whole system is flawed and it works against you, which means you end up with children who are older, who are traumatised, and who you then have to put a lot more effort into to try and make them happier and to try and resolve the issues that have been created because you've left them too long without support.
Yep.
And I know we've got graduated response in schools, meaning that you have different tiers of support, different levels of support. I know that. But, you know, for children like him, it's just not adequate enough. And yes, try it first. But they knew at the age of, was it 3 or 4?
Mm-hmm.
They knew at the age of 3 and 4 that he was not supported enough through that system. And yet they left him and left him and left him. And we had to wait longer and longer. And we kept being told, let's watch and wait. And we don't want to diagnose just in case it's not the right thing. You know, we want to be sure. But seriously, if you met my child, they say about people not looking autistic. He doesn't look autistic visually when you first see him, but when he starts doing his very stereotypical behaviours, like his hand flapping and all that kind of stuff, and his tics, it becomes very obvious to people, doesn't it, quickly, that he is autistic, because he presents a lot more stereotypically than our youngest child does, for example. So people have less of a hard time believing he's autistic, whereas we get people really not believing it with our youngest until he goes into meltdown. Because people have misconceptions that autism is literally just meltdowns and dysregulation and distress behaviour. And what they don't realise is that behaviour is because they're distressed and because they're dysregulated, and we need to get in there early and support them so that that is not their reality growing up as much as possible. I'm just so frustrated. And I think what my kind of final point was, I've always said the social and emotional needs for me and the support there is the most important, and I'm happy to pick up the academic side myself, but I don't like their attitude that they basically would just put him somewhere where there's no expectation. Like, you know,
he doesn't have to achieve anything academically.
No. And now I've got no issue, like, again, being very clear, he is a PDA-er. There's no way you could sit and just put him in a lesson anyway. He cannot tolerate timetables. He will not sit and do a timetable in a lesson in a very traditional way. However, he does need to be given the opportunity. And I think that's what I'm really cross about, is it's been done in a way that, okay, I don't know how to say this really without being rude. It's as though they just want to stick him somewhere to keep him out of our hair and to just put him into some kind of setting just to tick a box. And they're not actually thinking about whether it suits him. And they're not really worried about what he's going to get out of it either.
They don't care about the quality of his education. It's just, here goes a few life skills, and you're not expected to grow up to achieve anything.
No.
And to be an adult who can actually do anything worth noting.
And a lot of this comes back to what we've discussed before. A lot of the specialist settings local to us, they either seem to focus on social and emotional, or they focus on academic ability. But most of them are social and emotional. And again, that's such a priority. I'm not taking away from that. But again, you do need to give opportunities. I know somebody who went to a specialist school, and he's really bright, and he left with nothing. And yet his parents really asserted he was able, and they wanted him to leave with his core subjects. And no one listened, because I wonder if part of it is the teachers are not really qualified in that area. Because
not put out to deliver that. Meet that requirement.
No, I don't mean this rudely, but I've met a lot of SEND staff. So that is in all walks of life, I suppose. You have the support assistants, you have the teachers, even Senkos. And they seem to have a very limited view of autism. They use very traditional approaches for autistic children. And some settings obviously have children who are autistic, but they have a lot of physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, and their experience of autism is so very different to myself and to my son. Now, my son, obviously, and this is what they're getting confused by, because he is actually quite severe, in their words, not mine, in terms of his communication and behaviour. So because he's level 2 to 3 and he shifts on the scale, which is why low and high just doesn't work, He's quite severe. So therefore, they just want to put him somewhere where he doesn't have to do anything, really. But because he is actually cognitively able and he needs the stimulation, and I think that's the thing, he's a PDA. Like I said, I'm not expecting anyone to sit and do lessons with him, but you need to also stimulate him because he will get so bored. He needs that stimulation. And they aren't willing, they don't want to offer that. And now they don't know where to place him. And they're saying, this is an issue now, this is an issue. If it's somewhere where we can just send him and he's just learning life skills and that's it, and we don't have to do anything else, brilliant. But now you're saying that he's actually got some academic ability. Now we don't know what to do with him because they're not going, well, yeah. They're not going to, you know, that place might deal with his academic ability, but they won't give the social emotional. Why on earth for autistic children is it not the whole package? I don't understand it. Even when I was teaching in mainstream, which, again, was not all neurotypical children, it was children from so many different contexts, we just did not limit the ceiling. We did not say, this child is this, so they can only do this. It's absolutely, I just find it absolutely balmy. And the specialist settings, I'm sorry, I'm not attacking you, but you have smaller class sizes and better resources. I feel like some settings have been a bit arrogant, thinking they know everything and they need to now open their minds and extend their training and realise there are nuances to autism and that there is not a one-size-fits-all solution. And so far, a lot of the professionals I've met, they do not think outside of the box.
They exist in an echo chamber.
They do exist in an echo chamber. And this is what one of the posts I shared recently was about. People, I think, missed the point of the video I shared. It was somebody else's, not mine. I think it was Ella Elor again. And what she was trying to say, and I will admit, it probably could have been done in a different way to have made the point clearer, but I got what she was trying to say. And that is low and high functioning is just not adequate because we're all so individual. And for example, with my son, where does he fit then? It's just ridiculous. You know, because he can do a coding app and because he knows some maths and how to read, he's so high functioning. But everything else on that scale is so low. It just doesn't work that way. It's really frustrating. And, you know, as a result, there's nowhere for him to go. But they equally don't want to support us to keep him at home and to help me with a digital curriculum or any resources. It's just so frustrating. But the actual point she was also trying to make is just because you've worked with autistic people doesn't make you an expert. And some people said, of course it does. If you're a paediatrician or a psychiatrist and you work with autistic people, you'll understand the brain more than the autistic person themselves. And absolutely, if you've worked with autistic people for 20 years, you're going to know better than an autistic person. It's just not true.
That is what your neurotypical mind observes, but doesn't. It's just surface level. You're just looking at the external interaction. You're not actually going inside of the actual thought processes that are driving the autistic individual to make the choices. And even if you are attempting to, you're referring to some outdated textbook, which just isn't actually helpful.
I think that's the problem. A lot of them are out of date, and that's been our experience. I'm not saying there aren't some professionals who are amazing. We've met probably a handful. You know, there have been some really, I mean, the Ed Psych we saw for our youngest, for example, I actually wrote a really good review for her because she was amazing, so knowledgeable. Yeah, I wish everybody we've met was like her, but they haven't been. But she has obviously kept herself up to date. Like everything I fired at her, she knew. But the thing is,
you noticed something there.
What?
Younger.
Yeah, she was younger. No offense, but she was, and she's a bit more probably modern and up to date. Mm-hmm. And I think
willing to have an open mind. Yes. To stay up to date.
But we've met so many very arrogant so-called professionals who claim to know it all, but then you ask them questions or you fire things at them that you can find online, that you've learned online, or, you know, because I'm not saying every autistic person does this, but the majority of us, we kind of obsess over our special interest. And the majority of us, when we realise we're autistic, read everything about autism. And then some people say, oh, so you could just pretend you're autistic because you know enough of how to fake it. No.
Resonate deeply enough exactly. That you understand stuff at the microscopic level.
Yeah. And like for me, every bit of spare reading I do is about basically neurodiversity. So I know a lot about it, but I don't know everything because it's impossible. But I try and keep myself up to date and I learn from other advocates. And a lot of these professionals aren't doing that. They're not keeping themselves up to date. There were some that didn't know what PDA was, and I appreciate that's still relatively new. But to be
8 years old.
To be in 2020 and to not actually know what that is.
2021, we're going into 2022.
Totally shocking. And again, I'm not even going to go there because I've had professionals challenge me about that as well, saying, oh, it's not recognised. Well, actually, it's beginning to be more recognised everywhere, and I'm just not accepting that, to be honest.
It's come up to not far off a decade now. I mean, come on.
But it's not even just that. We've been to people who didn't know what the DSM-5 was, and yet one of the practitioners passed us a survey, a questionnaire that we had to complete with DSM-5 at the top. And I said, oh, DSM-5, this is from the DSM-5. The what, sorry? The DSM-5? Oh, what's that?
You're not familiar with the things you're handing out.
Okay, right, so you don't know what that is. And that was a consultant, by the way. So I think the thing is, you know, when you get people saying, I'm sorry, but they know more than you do, it's really frustrating because some might do, or some might know the mechanics, mm-hmm. but they don't know the lived experience.
Again, surface level box ticking. It's enough to appear knowledgeable. It's not actual deep level of understanding.
No. And actually, do you know the best professionals I've come across and, you know, have been in meetings with myself are the ones who are open to listening to the autistic voices and the autistic experience. And there's one professional that I've worked with. Now, this individual's not a health professional, but they have been very important, they've played a very important role in some projects to do with autism that I can't go into. But wow, the way that they listened to, but I suppose they coordinated in a way. They're the person mediating everything, if that makes sense, and bringing it all together. And I was so impressed with this individual, with the way they were able to kind of take every single view on board and collate it and summarize it and to take out the key points. And this individual actually mentioned me as an autistic person and said the level of experience and the thing, the knowledge I have surpasses a lot of the clinical members.
It will do.
In that group. Because his actual words were, she has lived and experienced and researched to such a degree that, you know, a clinician is going to take so many more years to get to that same space. So whose voice do you listen to? And that was, to me, a really validating moment, because obviously I'm not trained, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I understand what it's like to live it and to think it.
You have 37 years experience of the first person perspective, and you have just coming up 7 years experience of raising or neurodivergent children, as well as, 5 years of teaching them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you add all that up, and that's, you know, from three it's different valuable perspectives, yeah, including your own.
But again, I don't know everything and I would never claim to, but this is where I then get a bit agitated when people say, oh, excuse me, but I've worked with autistic children for 20 years. But then when you find out that they've worked with a particular, you know...
segment?
Yeah. Is that the word?
Why not?
They tend to use strategies like PECs, for example, and visual timetables and now and next boards, which are all legitimate things, even though recently there has been that study I published, or that article I published about PECs coming under ABA, which I didn't know about. So that's, I'm not a supporter of that personally.
Just because it's institutionally normalised doesn't make it non-traumatic.
No. But a lot of the things they peddle, and what have we had for our children? Oh, try this. It doesn't work. And then you get told that the problem is with the child, not the system they're using.
They always do that. They blame the individual, not the system itself.
Oh, they can't be properly autistic. And you're like, oh, my word.
Okay, because they don't fit neatly into your perception of what it is and your stereotypes. Therefore, you know, it's either that or that. Yeah. Okay.
I think this is what the problem is, you know, autism is not just one neat little box. And way back when they did have very neat kind of definitions, and it's become broader and people are learning more.
A series of neurological on and off switches in a certain configuration, which would then give that profile. So that's, as far as I'm concerned, it's the wiring and that's unique to each individual.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think we're going to leave it there. But my whole point is, I'm feeling triggered when people say, what admin is this kind of stuff? When people say, what's so challenging about raising different children? It's this kind of stuff. You know, yes, we have the day-to-day struggles with them, and that's difficult in itself. And you get shamed into thinking you're not allowed to ever say anything about how challenging your life is because you're being horrible about your children or you're being a martyr. But the fact is, there are some days where I want to just literally cry, hide away and cry, because it's tough. It's tough having children who don't understand things and are impulsive and reactive. And so you wind up getting hurt either verbally or physically, and they're not doing it on purpose. They can't help it. And you have to try not to take it personally, but it takes a toll on you. And then people say, think about how hard it is for your child. You're like, I do.
We always do.
We always put their needs and their feelings first. But I'm also a human being. And I just think, what has happened to this world where you are not allowed to also be human and have any feelings, emotions or difficulties and challenges? I'm also neurodivergent. So although that gives me such a level of privilege on one hand on being able to understand them, and I think it's really helped us to manage a lot of the difficulties they have, you know, I also have my own sensory issues, which I've discussed before. And so that gets triggered. And I've learned as an adult to deal with a lot of those things. I'll put the ear defenders on if I have to, that kind of stuff. But, you know, also when you have children who are so reliant on you, that I have one child who melts down or escalates and he has to go and have a bit of quiet time. I have another who, despite being very escalated and physical, doesn't want the quiet time. He still wants to be with you.
Yes.
So you don't, and they both need your attention constantly. You cannot even go on your phone. You can, you know, even if he's playing a game or watching something on television, you still have to be present and be involved in what he's doing. He cannot tolerate you not giving him your full attention. And then people who don't understand him will say, well, he needs to learn. That's all they get told by people, is he needs to learn, you're pandering. Try and live this every day, and then try not to feel exhausted and drained. And a lot of it is not actually from the child. It's all the crap. That's the only word I can use. It's all the crap you get from outside. And we have had crap, crap, crap. We've been crapped on, quite frankly, from everybody, from the moment he was born, with people's stupid opinions. From the age of 2, it became very obvious he was autistic and different to his peers. And we got dismissed, laughed at, first-time parents, ha, 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 until it became so obvious people couldn't deny it. And then those same people knew all along.
Yeah, it's funny how they rewrite history for their convenience so that it's on the side of the victor.
Some of this I know is repeated from other podcasts and other posts, but it is just too much for us to handle sometimes. Well, we do loop on it. We loop on it because, you know, this existence is not an easy one. And then people then put you down for doing what we're doing now and expressing it. And I have, like, literally had people online. I've had other advocates tell me, I've written on a post about this recently, but I've had other advocates tell me that my page will never be accepted by other autistic advocates because I present as an autism mum.
And how many of them have raised their own children?
And that frustrates me because actually I think only one advocate that I follow actually has children themselves. Actually, no, there are a few, but, you know, yeah, I'm not going to say what I was going to say there. But there's one advocate that actually has children. The rest do not.
So there you go.
And so they don't know yet what it's like. And I'm hoping in a way that they do have PDAs just like us. And that they can see that, yes, oh my gosh, they're amazing and they're brilliant and they're wonderful in so many ways. And we really don't want to change them whatsoever. We want to embrace them and we want them to feel confident in who they are. But it does come with a lot of difficulties. It's not an easy existence. Day to day is not easy because they resist everything. Every single day, every day demands. We try and create as low a demand environment as possible, but there are things with my eldest who's so impulsive and unsafe that you have to have clear no's, and you know, there are non-negotiables. And then you get some people say to you, well, you shouldn't, but they don't understand the lived experience and why we have to safeguard our children to the level we do. And there's too much to go into, but it's just really hard. And to be fair, on my space, I do feel it's a safe space on my page to come and share your challenges. It's not whinging about your children. I don't agree with whinging about your children. You know, we're so grateful to have them. But if you are having a hard time because you are not understood by other people about the challenges you and your children face, and you have professionals and local authorities not supporting you, you have every right to reach out for support. And I don't think anybody should feel ashamed about that. And so many of us, I know so many people, including other advocates who I've spoken to, who we all have to speak privately about these things, because otherwise some of the advocates attack you. Usually the ones who don't have children, no offence, but it's the truth. They will gang up on you because they see you as like the enemy of autism. And you're like, no. But at the same time, we can't sugarcoat it. There are challenges as well. And whilst I would never change my children, I would absolutely change the way that the system is currently run, because what is causing a lot of the problems in our household is we don't get any acknowledgement or understanding or support from outside of this home, apart from with, you know, a couple of lovely members of our family who do try and give us a bit of respite once a week for a couple of hours. It's a really, really tough existence. And I don't know, do you think we should have to not say anything about it?
You have the right to remain silent.
Yeah.
Anything you do say will be held against you. I'm misquoted, and as simple as that.
You know, I'm sorry it is late, I'm passionate, I'm triggered, and maybe I'll regret saying some of this tomorrow. But I just hope that people feel comfortable enough. You know, please reach out if you need any support. We appreciate more than anybody how tough these systems are to navigate. And next year, we are looking into ways that we can support parents with the processes of things like EHCP requests and any paperwork that's needed, quite frankly. I'm not saying, I can't promise that we're going to deliver, but we're going to try and do something to make this system easier for everybody, because to be honest with you, this last few years has been very emotionally draining, and they don't care. They don't care what we are put through. They don't actually care about our children. And I think that's what I've come to learn. And that's why I'm so emotional. And that's why I'm so triggered. And I think we do need to actually reach out to people who understand, and we need to support each other. And going forward, we need to try and change it so that other families don't go through this, because it's hell on earth, quite frankly. But I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for listening. Speak soon.